You're listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf. We interview creative minds and share their ideas. Here's your host, Annette Tour.
Welcome to East County Magazine Bookshelf. I'm your host, Annette Tour. My guest today is Dr. Thomas Gabor. Dr. Thomas Gabor is president of Thomas Gabor LLC, a criminal justice consulting firm based in Florida. He has served as a professor of criminology for 30 years at the University of Ottawa in Canada. He holds a doctorate from Ohio State University and has received the American Society of Criminology's Jean Carp Prize for his research in crime displacement. He is recognized both nationally and internationally as an expert in the areas of firearms and public safety, armed robbery, and crime prevention. He has over 200 publications and articles, including several books. He's listed among the most influential criminologists by a study published in the British Journal of Criminology. The Department of Homeland Security has designated him as an individual of extraordinary ability. Dr. Gabor, I am so honored to have you, and welcome to East County Magazine Bookshelf.
Thank you, Annette. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So today we are going to talk about your book, American Carnage, Shattering the Myths That Fuel Gun Violence, which you co-authored with Fred Gutenberg. For those of you who don't know, Fred Gutenberg is an American activist against gun violence, whose 14-year-old daughter, Jamie Gutenberg, was murdered in the Parkland High School shooting in Florida in 2018. So I have a few questions for you. The first question I'm curious about is, how did you get interested in criminology?
Well, I was studying sociology in Montreal, and I took a course on the sociology of deviant behavior, basically people who are outsiders, whether they're involved with the criminal justice system or some way different. And I was very fascinated by the course, liked the professor. And I think one of the other reasons that I'm involved in the field, being a former refugee, sometimes felt as an outsider myself, so I think I could identify a little better than some with those who are caught in the web of the justice system. So that's where my interest comes.
Fascinating. Well, I was reading the book, and I have to say the teacher in me just highlighted and annotated, because there is so much information here, and you really bring fiction to fact. So one of the questions I wanted to have, bring a little history, is to start off. I was surprised that in the book it states that in the Wild Wild West, or the American frontier, there were strict gun laws back in those days. Could you give a few examples of what has changed over the years?
Yes, and that is one of the greatest myths in our book. And many people refer to it as a foundational myth, because there are all these misconceptions about the founding of this society. And in fact, from the revolutionary period to the frontier days, there was generally more strict gun control in some ways than today. An example would be that in the mid-19th century to the end of the 19th century, virtually every state outlawed the carrying of concealed weapons. And now today, by contrast, beginning in the 80s, there were, at the behest and promotion of the gun lobby, from the 80s on, we've had these right to carry laws. And so now in every state, you can carry a firearm. And we've also started removing the necessity for getting a permit to carry. So in 26 states now, and counting, Florida is the 26th, by the way, and it's the law is coming into effect on July 1st. There is no requirement. You can carry a firearm without any training, any knowledge of guns, any knowledge of the law, and when it's appropriate to use lethal force. So, you know, the gun lobby tries to give this impression that by deregulating gun carrying, for example, that we're returning to our roots, when in fact, it's not the case at all. And there was strict gun control, as you say, even in the Old West, in places like Dodge City and Tombstone, Arizona. So there are many misconceptions, but that's the biggest one. So really, some of the laws, especially pertaining to the carrying of guns, are far more extreme today.
Wow. Let's talk about the myth in your book that states that an armed society is a polite society. How often are people killed by their own guns?
Well, people are killed by their own guns in over 50% of cases of lethal episodes involving guns. So the last year for which we have complete data on firearm deaths in this country indicates that we have over 48,000 gun deaths a year. Over half of those are suicides. So doing some quick math, about 25,000 or so individuals kill themselves each year with firearms. And people may say, you know, there's a misconception that somebody who is determined to kill themselves will do so eventually. But in fact, we know from suicidologists, people who study suicides, that the vast majority of people who attempt suicides don't attempt it again, that they don't have a strong desire to die, but feel overwhelmed by some crisis that they're going through. So if they attempt suicide once with firearms, there's close to 90% chance that they will kill themselves. Whereas if they use drugs and so forth and overdose, it's about 2 or 3%. So firearms are the most lethal way of committing suicide. So it's very preventable.
One common statement we hear over and over again is the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. How often do gun owners actually prevent crimes in relation to committing crimes?
Not often relative to the number of crimes that are committed with firearms and harms. So first, if you look at mass shootings, there was one study done by the FBI that found of 160 what they call active shooter incidents in public, only in one case was the shooting thwarted by an armed civilian. And that armed civilian happened to have a military background. So it doesn't happen often. And now, in general, I'll give you one number in one study, a real credible study that looked at gun homicides involving guns kept in the home. For every time an intruder is shot by a homeowner, there are 22 times as many cases in which the gun is turned on somebody in that household. So there's either a domestic shooting, a suicide attempt, or some tragic accident within the home. So yes, there are cases where guns are used in self-defense, but there are far more cases in which these guns are turned on family members and that, you know, some criminal action takes place or suicide. So therefore, it's the reason we say that there is no net benefit of gun ownership in society as a whole.
Now, am I correct with the statistics that actually 70% of Americans do not own guns? That means only 30% of Americans are gun owners?
Absolutely. And that's another misconception, you know, around the world. And even Americans are surprised by that statistic. You know, we're viewed as a nation, not just awash in guns, but with a uniformly having a gun lust or gun fetish, when in fact, as you say, only about a third of Americans, and it's been declining. There was a little bit of an upsurge during the pandemic, because sometimes Americans, due to fear, insecurity, arm themselves, and we have some new gun owners in the country, but two-thirds still do not own a firearm. And then if we look at within the gun-owning community, there's a subgroup that's about 6% of the U.S. population that owns two-thirds of the guns in this country. So there's a real concentration of ownership. And the folks that we might call extremists in this area, they're a very small percentage of gun owners. Now, why is it important to point that out? First of all, most of us are not gun owners, and we too have rights, you know, including the right to life, which among other things was enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. But as well, that most gun owners too are not extremists and support some basic measures to reduce gun violence. So we have this relatively small minority in the country with disproportionate influence on the political level, and manage with the help of the gun lobby to keep fairly weak laws in place in a lot of the country.
Guns have always been around. Why only in the last 30 years are there so many mass school shootings? What has changed?
Well, there is an epidemic of, first of all, loneliness, but also of depression and even suicide among young people. There's been a strong increase, quite striking increase with respect to suicide among the young. You know, and there's a lot of evidence that young people are less tethered to society today than they used to be. They're less likely to participate in, say, afternoon and other or after school and other organized programs. And people who are socially isolated with fewer friends and so forth. So that might explain some of the motive for acting out. I think now, why do they act out in the way that they sometimes do with mass shootings? Well, first of all, guns, especially these weapons of war, are far more available today than they were 20 years ago. 20 years ago, 2% of gun sales were of this AR-15 variety. Today, it's 25%. So you have some conditions that lead young people to be more desperate. They also draw cues from people before them who've engaged in mass shooting. So it's kind of contagious. We're in a cycle where, you know, young people are emulating previous shooters, and then they're enabled by easy access to firearms, especially these deadly firearms that are more deadly, I should say, than were available in the past.
I suppose this ties into the topic of mental illness, because you hear every time there is a mass shooting, then the topic of mental illness comes up. Is there a disconnection or loneliness in society that triggers this violence in people?
Well, again, you know, every indication is that people have fewer friends. I just saw a survey that showed that adults as a whole, 25% fewer adults today than, say, 20 years ago, can say that they have five or more friends. So again, people are getting more isolated. Now, you know, the pandemic, which leads people to work more remotely, is in some ways further isolating individuals. So that's one of the downsides. I know there are upsides to working remotely. And you know, all these factors play into it. But isolation is a big factor. Now, for example, we have, just by example, you look at people like Cruz, the shooter in Florida and the Parkland shooting, and you look at the shooter at the Sandy Hook shooting. These were two very socially isolated individuals. So they're not all that way. There are mass shootings for a whole lot of other reasons, including workplace related shootings. You have conflicts between groups and other factors, but there's an element that commits these random shootings and who is or are socially isolated. There's even a group that referred to them as incels, I-N-C-E-L-S, involuntary celibate, which refers to the socially awkward individuals who don't fit into society and are unable to find the social partner, an intimate partner. And a number of these individuals have struck back at society. You may recall, as a former Montrealer yourself, that there was this horrible shooting at the University of Montreal back in 1989. And the fellow went into the School of Engineering and separated the men from the women and started shooting. He murdered 15 women attending school. And when we looked at his past, he shared some of those frustrations. He had anger against women. He blamed women for all his problems and basically the problems around the world. So there is a category of shooter that fits into that profile.
Yes, I remember that horrible shooting and hearing about it and being shocked. And I think the number one comment was, this doesn't happen in Canada. Mm-hmm. This only happens in the United States. I want to talk about another myth that you mentioned in your book, which people probably have heard of, is guns don't kill people, people kill people, and potentially any good guy could turn to a bad guy. So what percentage of homicides are spontaneous versus planned out?
The majority of homicides are not what we call premeditated. They are not. And so whether they are due to arguments, that's the number one reason, motive for homicide, some kind of dispute between individuals or groups of people. Another big category are felony killings, where somebody commits a robbery, a rape, or some other crime, and they didn't intend to, but they eventually, for some reason, they end up killing the victim or a witness. So the vast majority of killings are relatively spontaneous. And that's why the presence or absence of guns becomes more consequential. Because, you know, you have the argument again from the gun lobby and their allies that, you know, if somebody wants to kill, they can, and they will eventually kill another person. And they can, you can even kill with a, they say, a frozen ham or a hammer and so on. And while that's true, since most killing is rather spontaneous, whether an individual has a deadly weapon, such as a gun, or no weapons at all, or possibly a knife in their possession, it makes all the difference in the world. Because we know, for example, when we compare gun attacks with knife attacks, there's a gun attack is at least three times as likely to end up in death and become a homicide than a knife attack. So it's really very consequential, the fact that, first of all, most killings are not premeditated. And second of all, the presence or absence of lethal weapons is very consequential in assaults.
What would you say to, there are countries such as Finland, Canada, and Switzerland with relatively high gun ownership and low crime rates. How are these countries different than the U.S.?
There are massive differences in that. Well, first of all, gun ownership in the U.S. is still an outlier. So we have about 120 guns for every 100 people. And none of the countries you mentioned, really no country in the world comes close to U.S. in terms of its level of privately held firearms. But there are other significant differences. Most advanced countries have a system of licensing whereby there's more of a stronger vetting of who should and should not own guns. And there are interviews with law enforcement, reference checks, and even mandatory training on the part of gun owners. In the U.S., we have a very weak background check system, in my view. It's not just weak because people who buy in the private market don't have to pass a background check at all, but the background check system, when one buys from a dealer, is about a two-minute check of three FBI databases. So if a person doesn't have a criminal conviction, they might show a lot of disturbing behaviors, like Nicholas Cruz, for example, who committed the Parkland shooting. But and every of his one of his schoolmates pretty well said he would be the leading candidate to be a school shooter. But he, strictly speaking, didn't have a criminal conviction, a felony conviction, and therefore could still go and purchase his firearm. So the background check system is much weaker. Other countries have a licensing system. Another way that the U.S. is an outlier is it's permissible to own guns for self-protection. This isn't the case in Canada, for example. In Canada, you have to make a very strong case to carry guns for the purpose of self-protection. You have to prove that you are in imminent danger of death, say from an estranged spouse, and that nobody, law enforcement or nobody else, can protect you. So you have a strong onus on the individual. Here it's an entitlement to own a gun for self-protection. And so those weapons are handled very differently. And we have a lot more gun carrying than is the case in other countries. In many countries, there aren't many handguns, or they're considered restricted weapons. So there's some very fundamental differences. We have more guns. We have more gun carrying. We have gun carrying for the purposes of self-protection. We have poor vetting, and we don't have mandatory training like other countries. And we also don't have, final point I'd make here is, we don't have a national safe storage law that requires people to store guns, especially out of the reach of children. And other countries do have some kind of national safe storage. And there's only one state in the United States, Massachusetts, that requires every firearm in the household to be secured, locked, unloaded, and so forth. So we, in general, have very weak laws in the United States as far as storage is concerned.
80% of Americans believe in stricter gun laws. Why is it then so hard to pass these laws that will protect Americans?
First of all, we have a very much a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, which has passed some laws, rulings that some people would say distorts the meaning of the Second Amendment and is leading to many laws that are on the books in different states to be challenged. So even assault weapons bans are being challenged because of the interpretation of the Second Amendment. So that's one issue. And there's certainly the conservative majority court today is not representative of the general population. There's also a gun lobby that we've had that, while somewhat weakened these days due to scandal, the NRA in particular, they were one of the most powerful lobbies in the country and still have the ability to mobilize their members so that legislators are afraid of them and know that, you know, if they propose strong gun laws, the gun lobby will mobilize their constituents against them. So they're a very powerful lobby group. And finally, in general, gun owners as a whole tend to be more active politically than activists, say, on the other side of this issue. They are more likely to donate to political campaigns, more like they're much more vocal. They contact their representatives more often. So they are much single issue voters frequently and much more influential and active than folks who wish to see change in this area. And it's why I urge people who want to see change to get as active as those on the other side of this debate, because we are in the majority. As you've pointed out, recent polls, even the Fox News poll, found that 80% or more of Americans are in favor of many of the measures that we seek, from expanding background checks to these red flag laws to raising the age for gun purchases and so on. So if the majority was to become far more active and far more vocal, that could make a significant difference. Because just to give you an example, Australia had a major change in 1996 following a massacre there of 35 people. The country, while having strong roots in terms of gun ownership, a frontier, a strong gun lobby, there were many similarities with the United States, 90% of the population demanded change. And there was a conservative government, a new government, that brought about change and worked with the states there in Australia to bring about national reform in this area. So outrage on a wide scale is really important. And I think we're starting to get closer, but we're not quite there in the United States.
Well, that's all the time we have today, Dr. Gabor. It has been my honor to speak with you. The book is American Carnage, Shattering the Myths That Fuel Gun Violence. Thank you for being on the show, and best of luck in your future endeavors.
Thank you, Annette. It's been really nice to be with you today.